Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different.
Yeah, way different.
Yeah, this is going to be Brandon Mole being the host and moderator, interviewing, which now I'm speaking with a foreign accent, interviewing Jason Conforto, who normally is interviewing me. And this is because Jason, in his own right, is a filmmaker by trade and is somebody who loves media and who is inventive in all sorts of different ways. He's made board games. He has all these podcasts and loves getting creative with role-playing games and doing weird, cool Dungeons and Dragons podcasts. And on top of that is making commercials and corporate videos and getting creative with documentaries. And he's just kind of like a creative renaissance man in a lot of ways. He's somebody that I've used to feedback my books since I was a young writer before I was published. And that's because he has a really great creative brain. So today we get to dive into the brain a little bit of Jason Conforto.
Yeah. And a good note too, is this was your idea as well.
Yeah. He wants this to be clear that it was my idea. And that's an act of humility because it was my idea.
I'll also say I'm not humble by nature either. I am pretty braggadocious, as they say. So
yeah. When I first met Jason, we were working at Excel Entertainment, and I thought his vibe was sort of the vibe of a mean big brother, and like a mean big brother who loves you but is also mean. Like that was kind of the vibe. Yeah. And it's funny because he's actually younger than me.
Right.
But he carries around a pretty good mean big brother vibe sometimes. But part of the fun of Jason is behind that is a really sensitive, smart, interesting guy who I consider one of my very best friends. And so we are today going to talk about Jason. When you went to school, you went to BYU.
Right.
And with the aim of becoming a filmmaker.
Yeah. And even before that, I went to BYU, first of all, chasing the love of my life. So
was that part of what got you there?
Natalie had brought me to BYU. We grew up in San Diego together, and she, after my mission, was at BYU. So I was like, I guess I'm moving to Utah. But before my mission in San Diego, where I grew up, we had a weekly show that we produced at the high school. And I was the director and producer of that weekly show, and I had Miss Blizzard. She was my Esty Live. That's the name of the show. She was our teacher and mentor for that show, and really just got me hooked on production. But then on my mission, I was like, I can't really do film for a living. And so when my first few semesters at BYU, I was taking I was a communications major, because I was afraid, I picked a major that was adjacent to film, and it wasn't until I was in a comms law class, which was like a pre-law class. It's the worst. It was the worst experience of my collegiate career, as if I played sports, right? But I was like, why am I doing this? I have no interest in any of this. The only reason I'm taking comms classes is because I want to be in film. And so if I want to be in film this bad, then let's just switch to a film major.
Let's just jump in with both feet.
And fortunately, I made the choice right at the time where I could leave comms with a minor, and then that was just taken care of, and it didn't really cost me any time or anything like that. I could just jump right into film and focus on that.
Jason, it's funny because I did the exact same thing with writing.
Yeah.
I was a comms major because it was writing adjacent. PR was my emphasis, and I was an English minor, and my goal was to write novels.
Yeah. I think part of being a comms major, and this is universal, they're all cowards. They're afraid to do what they really want. No, I'm joking. I'm sure there's great people in comms. But there are a lot of people in that major that are wanting to do something else and something different.
So interesting to me that the film itch for you started, did it start in high school or did it start before high school?
It was like junior high. It was one of my very best friends, Ryan Brayman. He made a video for his English class. He was a year older than me. It was Oedipus Rex, and we did a modern version of Oedipus Rex, and it was hilarious. And he directed it, and he filmed it, and we did this thing where he did all the voices, and we just mouthed whatever he was saying, and he was just hilarious. And I got to play the lead role in that, and I was just hooked. I was like, I want to make movies for the rest of my life. And yeah, that's what got me into it was making movies with my friends and in the backyard. We made little Indiana Jones spoofs with our friends and did all that stuff. And just constantly writing scripts. And most of our scripts were really action scenes, right? We were doing that. I remember in high school, during PE, I had some sort of injury. And so I was sitting on the bench and, I had a little notebook and I was drawing, diagrams for a fight scene. Right. And this really cute girl came up to me and she's watching what I was drawing and she's like, "Oh, are you on the basketball team or football team?" Like, cause it looked like
you were diagramming a play.
It was like X's and O's doing this stuff. And I'm like, "No, it's for a fight scene that I'm writing." and that's where the conversation ended.
That's really funny. Yeah. That's really funny. Yeah, it's perfectly what we... Yeah, I can so understand that. I made a movie with my friends in Connecticut in high school called Jedi the Movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a bunch of action scenes spliced together. We had similar childhoods, I'm realizing. But so you get to BYU... You move from comms to film.
Mm-hmm.
I know a big part of the film program is you get to actually make movies.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a hands-on kind of program. Tell me about your experience there.
You know, there's two big projects I did at BYU, which were my junior film and my senior film. And the whole program kind of revolved around, especially on the directing track, it was preparing for these two films and producing them and doing everything. And part of making that successful was finding the right team to help you do it, because filmmaking is a team sport. Fortunately, at the time at BYU, I have no idea what it's like now, but all the film students, we would just help on each other's projects. And so I remember I was asked to be an assistant director on a student film that this kid was making at BYU, and I didn't even know what an assistant director was, right? And it turns out it was not... It's like the least glamorous position on set. You're basically the crew's boss, and you're over time. You're making sure everybody's in the right place at the right time. You're staying on schedule, and it's the exact opposite of like creativity, right?
Yeah, you're like formatting things.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
you're organizing things.
You're kind of
right.
Like the crew boss, right? You're not. It's a very uncreative role, and I hated it. Right. But then I got known as the assistant director. And so whenever another student would be making a movie, they'd be like, who can AD? Well, Jason can AD. So I was able to bounce on a bunch of shoots all through BYU, which was awesome because then you get to know all the students. And then when it was time to shoot my films, all these people that I helped showed up and helped me make these.
Everybody owed you a favor.
Yeah, yeah, and it was great. And you know, and then there was other kids that I hardly knew who were coming up in the ranks, and they volunteered to be on my film knowing that I would be gone. And then they, you know, it just continued. They weren't doing it because they knew I'd help them on theirs, but they're just part of the culture that was there.
It wasn't always transactional.
Right.
You had some people planting trees whose shade they would never enjoy.
Exactly. Exactly.
And isn't that beautiful?
But it was fun. And I went to school with some household names that you guys would all know. My junior film, the director of photography, the guy behind the camera shooting it, was Jared Hess. And I still remember
who made Napoleon Dynamite and the Minecraft movie and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, big time director, and he I remember working with him on the project. He had a vision for one of the shots that I thought sounded a little hokey, but I was like, hey, we'll give it a try. And it ended up awesome. And I recently recreated that shot in a project that I did with John Heater a few months ago,
where
I was directing a commercial, where I was like, okay, I just kind of keeping that in mind. So, and then my senior film, John Heater was in that one. He was a small bit part, and it was right at the time he was about to shoot Napoleon Dynamite with Jared Hess. They may have actually had already shot it. I know they had shot Palooka by then, which was the precursor to Napoleon Dynamite. But those are the guys that I went to school with. Some other, a lot of people still working in the industry and just some of my closest friends. One of our really good friends, Cole Glass, who's in our small circle of friends in one of the groups that we have. And, he was... He's part of that group that I still work with today and hang out with personally. So, yeah, BYU is a great film program and a great time to be there for sure.
And so what was your next step as you tried to move into this industry? As you get this chance to make a senior film, you do some good work. What happens after that?
Yeah, right. Immediately, two things happened right after I graduated. One, I got accepted to the master's program in Pasadena at Art Center, right? And I think that's where your cousin...
Cousin Mike.
Yeah, Cousin Mike went to school. I went out there and checked out the school. I was accepted into the program. I looked at what life would be like in Pasadena, and I had two little kids, and I was like, I don't think I want to raise my family here. We were looking at like what we could afford living wise, and we're looking at these small little houses or apartments with like bars on the window and stuff like that. And I was like, I grew up in San Diego. It wasn't Pasadena, but I couldn't imagine raising my kids in an area where I wouldn't be comfortable with them playing outside and doing whatever, right? It really was those images on the bars on all the windows there. It's just like, am I going to raise my kids in some prison where it's not safe?
You know? Where the front yard is scary.
Right. So, and then on top of that, it was expensive too. It was like $10,000 a semester. And that was in the early 2000s. And I was like, I'm going to be in debt the rest of my life if I do this. And so that was happening, and I decided not to do that program. And right as that was happening, Jason Fowler and Kynan Griffin produced the LDS Pride and Prejudice, or the Pink Pride and Prejudice, right? Yeah. And they're like, who can we get as an AD? And they're like, oh, Jason ADs. And so I AD'd my first feature film right out of college. And that was one of the hardest working environments I've ever had in my life, where we were, I think our shortest day in our 4 weeks of filming was like 15 hours. Our longest day was over 24 hours. It's like 26, 27 hours straight.
So a lot was being asked from everybody.
It was. And I was the highest paid crew on set, and I was making $400 a week.
Wow.
which is nothing.
So everybody was working for peanuts.
Yeah, everybody was working for peanuts. They actually fired me the last week of shooting because they couldn't afford me anymore.
Oh, funny. Yeah.
So, but they I still got the credit for it. And they even had me come play a bit part in the film after they let me go as the assistant director, which I was fine with. It was the biggest relief when I was released from that film, because it was like, I would go home at night and I would sleep, but all the sleep would be just like fitful dreams about being on set. And it was just, and I kind of wondered, like, if this is what film is, maybe it's not for me.
So it sounds to me like that was a fairly extreme, unusual situation.
For sure. But not extreme for independent film. Right.
Right.
And not extreme for low budget stuff. And it's one reason why films cost so much, is because it's designed to prevent you from taking advantage of people, right? And so so budget, everything costs a lot of money because you're otherwise you're abusing these people. And since then, I've also learned, like, part of filmmaking, you have to have you have to have three parts of it. One, you've got to make money, right? You've got to be doing this craft in a way that you're making money. And on the flip side, you have to be doing projects where you're giving back and you're working for free, right? And so you've got to balance that. And when you first start, it might be like 90% free and 10% work, but eventually it needs to be like 90% you're getting paid, 10% you're donating for free. Well, 10% is a lot, right? But you know, I was recently a few years ago, I was in a BYU commercial. It was students that were making spec ads, right? And a spec ad is just an ad that you do for a company, but they haven't hired you to do it. You're just doing it for free on spec, and there's no like tie to the actual project. And it was a Dungeons and Dragons commercial that they were making, and somebody texted me and was like, "Hey, you should be in this commercial. This is right up your alley." And so they sent me the casting call, and there was a character that needed like a big beard and was a big gruff guy and this barbarian that was supposed to be in this commercial. And I was like, yeah, I could play the barbarian role. Turns out, first of all, as a D&D guy, it wasn't a barbarian. It was a ranger. But but yeah, I had this beard, and I really felt like I was being cast because of my beard, right? Like that's what it was. But I auditioned for this part, and then they called me back. They gave me the part, and turns out that not only was the barbarian or the ranger the lead, but like in a major way, like the whole commercial revolved around this guy, right? This is a long story for a very small point I'm making. I'm in this commercial. I have a blast doing it. And it comes to the end, and I'm meeting with the director, who I think we agreed back to like $400 for the part or something like that. And I remember asking him, like, okay, first of all, where's this money coming from? Like, if BYU is paying for this, or if this is department money, then yeah, I'll take $400. Yeah, no problem. In fact, I'm getting underpaid for 3 days of work, right? So
sure.
So I'll take it. But no, he's like, no, this is, you know, it's a student project. It's coming out of my pocket. And so it's like, okay, then this is one of those times where I'm going to dedicate my craft for free to students, right? And being able to do that was reward enough for that. And so as going back to this whole point, as a filmmaker, you have to find projects where you can help for free on, where you're giving to the next generation coming up. You have to have projects that are paying you. And then the third category is you have to have passion projects, projects that you believe in, that you're passionate about. When you're in film school, you can kind of do whatever you want, right? You can initiate projects and do that. In real life, like, unless you're completely loaded, you can't do whatever you want. You're at the mercy of whoever's hiring you to film stuff. And so you lose that creative freedom in a way. And so to keep your sanity now, you have to have some sort of passion project that you do.
Yeah. If you want to make something, you have to be able to hustle people
so much
such that you can get the support you need to make it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't realize that so much of being a filmmaker was being a con artist.
Yeah.
Right. which sounds awful, but it's unfortunately true. Like, and con artists, that's not true, but you do have to sell your vision. You have to sell what you see, and you've got to get people excited to be a part of your team and what you're doing. So
yeah, con artist in the sense of you have to convince investors to believe in a vision,
right?
That they're going to invest in something that is traditionally fairly high risk,
mm-hmm.
but hopefully this is going to be one of those times where the high risk pays off,
right?
And yeah, like con artist.
yeah, exactly. You know,
which is not completely, but kind of.
But unfortunately, more true than not, where especially with independent film, there are a lot of producers that are promising a return on investment that they just can't promise, right?
It isn't realistic.
It's not realistic, and shouldn't be promised. And a lot of people have lost a lot of money in the independent film industry because of that, right? And
it's sort of a gambler's game if you're an investor, because every now and then something hits and you can make a lot of money, sort of like going to Vegas. Like sometimes you can win.
And sometimes they're not, and hopefully you're getting money from people that can afford to lose money, right? First of all. And so sometimes they're paying for an experience. They're paying to be front row on a film set and to be an executive producer and to be a part of the filmmaking process at a way that they can be involved with. My experience with that is not very vast, though. I don't have a ton of experience raising money and producing films that I've raised money for. That hasn't been in my experience. So the good side of that is I don't owe anybody a lot of money. The bad side of that is that I haven't produced or directed feature films in a way that I thought I was going to after I graduated from college.
Before we get too far from this, I just want to note that I think you said something important about donating some time, donating some, there's different ways to serve in life, right? And one of the most beautiful ways I think to serve is serving with specialized service, where you have specialized in something. And because you've specialized in something, you can serve in a way that few others can.
Right.
You know, it's nice to go help dig a ditch where most people could go help with that if they were able-bodied, you know, fairly. And yet it is really different to be able to help on a movie.
Right.
Or different for me if I can help somebody work on a story, right? And I remember there is, like, Stephen King would have his dollar babies, which is, like, I think my understanding is that some of his short stories he would license for a dollar to aspiring film students, right?
I'm familiar with that.
And give them a shot. Like that's someone at a very high level living that out, right?
Yeah.
And I think I heard Denzel Washington say, like, the first third of your career is to learn, the second third is to earn, and the final third is to return.
Yeah.
Right. And that doesn't have to happen necessarily in order. But I think that if you remember to give back, I think that creates the kind of connection that sometimes can be really A, professionally useful, and B, just personally useful. Because part of being an artist is that it helps if you're kind of whole inside. You know what I mean? Which is a struggle on planet Earth.
Yeah. And because I'm a filmmaker, I don't have a lot of talents. You know what I mean? Like if I have a neighbor call me up and say, "Hey, I my car isn't working. Can you help me fix it?" It's like you've called the wrong neighbor. Like my willingness is there, my ability is just not there. I'm not a man's man when it comes to that stuff.
There's somebody else in the neighborhood who can do that specialized service.
But yeah. I have made movies with youth in the neighborhood, right? And I've done that for youth programs and other stuff, and so there are ways where I can give back. But like you said, it's highly specialized, and those opportunities don't come very often. But when they do, I try to take them. I mean, you kind of do the same thing with doing conferences for young writers and whatnot like that. Like trying to be a mentor to a large group of people, which isn't the same as a one-on-one mentor, but those times can be inspiring.
There are times I get paid to present at conferences, and there are times when I go do that for free. And there have been many, many, many times when I've gone to be a cheerleader for reading at a school for free.
Yeah.
Much, much, much more than I've been paid to do it. And so, yeah, we all have our ways we kind of give back and try to do a little bit.
Yeah. But when was the last time you fixed someone's car?
Yeah, never. Yeah,
never.
Never.
And when will you? Never. Yeah,
I beg friends to help me fix my car.
Yeah,
that's how it works.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But like, let's return to where you're at, because I think you're in a place where that to me is a very relatable place, mm-hmm. where you had gone to school, you wanted to make movies, and you then got out of school, and you've maybe never made the big feature movies that you've always wanted, and yet you have worked in the industry this whole time.
Yeah.
And so make sense of how how that has happened. Like how did that take shape? How did you build a life that where you did get to make film part of your life?
Yeah, and part of it, I mean, the next step in my journey is when I met you, right? It was after that Pride and Prejudice thing, I got a job distributing feature films for Excel Entertainment, and you joined our team probably a year after I was there, and that was my first experience doing film adjacent work, right?
Yeah.
Where I was the one on the team that would sit down in the edit bay as we cut commercials and trailers and that kind of stuff, where it felt really familiar and almost like filmmaking in those moments. But then also, you know, you and I would go to theaters and we'd stand up in front of, you know, 500 people and do our little speech about, you know, getting your friends and family to go see this opening weekend and whatever it is, right?
Yeah, or literally wearing plastic soldier helmets, handing out flyers at a minor league baseball game.
Yes, yes.
And all sorts of interesting
all sorts
moments.
Of things we've done. Flyering cars. Oh, my gosh. It was miserable. Or buying full theaters full of tickets for empty theaters
to make it look like people were going to a certain movie because a certain person needed that to happen.
Yeah,
but like,
but so.
But we were also getting to be, because I was there, so I can relate to this directly. Not only were we sometimes doing silly things and working back in the warehouse, we were also kind of like senior executives at this distribution house,
right?
And you got to make senior executives
in action, not in pay or title.
Yeah. We were
or
not
respect.
We were not paid much, but we got the job experience as if we were very high level executives at a studio.
Yeah, Excel Entertainment was a life changing opportunity for, I think, for both of us. It was an awesome experience. From there, I ended up working for Vineyard. Which they did the work in the Glory movies and other stuff. I shot their behind the scenes documentaries for the Work in the Glory films, the second and third one, and then I also did the distribution. I headed up the distribution team for those two films as well. And then from there, I went to a company called Avalanche Studios, and I've been with Avalanche Studios for coming on like 20 years. And Avalanche Studios was a video production company that officed right next door to Excel Entertainment. So I knew Dave Lindsay, the owner of the company, and when I was done with Vineyard, I didn't have many opportunities. Doors were closing all over the place. A lot of the people that I went to film school with had already kind of dissipated and got real jobs elsewhere. There's still a core that work in the industry, but we were dropping off like flies, those who could get jobs doing this kind of stuff. And a lot of the more successful ones went out to LA and had great careers there and are still working in the industry. But at Avalanche Studios, I was kind of a freelance guy there for like the first like decade that I worked for Avalanche. It was on a freelance type thing where I would find a project and I'd bring it to Dave. And since I brought it in, he would pay me to produce the project. Right. And my role there was creating work. Right. And I made a career out of creating work and becoming a producer. But for a time, you know, just imagine trying to be a freelancer while you've got five kids at home, you've got a wife and kids, and sometimes I would work a 40-hour week and have at the end of the week like 6 or 7 billable hours, right? And that was a tough road for a long, long time, until finally I got hired on full time at Avalanche Studios. But the career at Avalanche has allowed me to produce and direct feature documentaries and be involved with some great films there and then also some really high level commercials that I've been able to direct or produce as well. But at the same time, there are other projects that I've done there that have been projects that are paying the bills. You know what I mean? It's not the big creative thing that you're hoping for, especially as a young college student who thinks, oh, I'm going to be the next Steven Spielberg. And it's like, oh no, you're going to be the next corporate video producer, right? It's a very different feel.
But there's a lot of people who would think that producing videos and corporate videos would be a lot of fun, and they can't even swing that. You know what I mean? And so it's like you have found a beautiful thing that's happened is you have found a niche where you do get to make film your life, you know, and there's in what ways by making commercials, making documentaries, making some of the stuff you do get to make at Avalanche, is that still preparing you or keeping a door open to do other things you might be interested in doing?
Absolutely. You know, I reconnected recently with one of my very best friends from high school who we did film together. And I showed him some projects that I had done recently that he was really impressed with and thought was really cool. And we were texting back and forth, and I mentioned, oh, I've got this dumb shoot tomorrow that I'm going to be on. And he thought it was like this humble brag, like, oh, don't worry, like tomorrow I'm on another shoot. And he called me out on it. And I'm like, no, it really isn't a humble brag. Like this is like, I'm not excited about this shoot. This is kind of low level stuff. And he's like, what are you talking about? It's like, we dreamed our whole lives of being on set, and tomorrow you're going to be on set and you're complaining about it. It's like, what are you doing? You're living the dream. And there is some truth to that. Like I spend a lot of time on set. I get to produce a lot. I produce more than I direct. But it's cool. And I do tell people all the time, it beats working. Like what I do, it's fun.
Yeah.
But to get back to your question, like, I don't think my career is stagnant or over, right? I think there are, my goal is to direct a feature film and have that experience. I've directed feature documentaries, but I'm talking like a feature narrative film and whether it's a streaming or a theatrical release, I'd like to direct a big film at some point in my life, and the sooner the better, for sure.
Sure.
But I think that there are things in my life that are still preparing me for those opportunities. Most recently, I directed a series of I was going to say national, but they're really international. It was an international company that hired me to direct a series of commercials starring John Heder, and that was an awesome experience. Like, and you stopped on.
Yeah, I came by the set because it was a big deal. There was tons of people there, and it was very professional. And I would assume it would be much like how it would feel to be on any feature movie set.
Yeah,
because I mean, there was all the gear and there was all the professionals, and yeah, talk about it.
Yeah, it was huge, and I got to work with. With three people that I went to college with too, that were on that set too, including John Heder and Bianca Klein, who shot it, and Jonas Sappington. They like these were all people that I went to school. Oh, and Dan Heder too, right? So there's five of us together that all went to college and ended up on this shoot together. But it was one of those things where I've worked on big sets, where I was like doing behind the scenes documentaries, right? Where I wasn't the producer or the director. I have produced very big commercials. I produced this huge one for, a company in Indonesia, and they shot it out here, and we had a huge crew, and it was great. I was producing it, but I wasn't like the director. I wasn't in charge of the vision and whatnot. But this one came, and I was the director, and I got to sit in that seat and share my vision with the crew, and then have them just bring it to life. And I was in heaven for 3 days. It was a huge highlight in my career. And I know a lot of the people that I was working with on this shoot, it wasn't a highlight in their career, right?
Yeah. You know, for them, it was a job.
Yeah, it was a job. And they'd done bigger projects and bigger things. But for me, it was a great thing. And for those of you listening and who listen to our podcast, you should have put two to two together now that when Brandon came out and visited us on set, that was the same night we recorded with John and Dan Heder and had them on our podcast as well. So,
That's right. That created that opportunity.
That was a cool one.
So here's the thing. When I was a young writer And this is hopefully something everybody can relate to who's listening to this podcast. If they, you know, if they want to write novels and make that their day job and that hasn't happened yet, right? Which is, that's where I was for a long time. Mm-hmm. For me, I wanted to write novels and I ended up writing marketing stuff at Excel and ended up writing marketing stuff at a publisher called Deseret Book. And it was adjacent to what I like to do. And there was a part of me that was very happy that I could go to work and primarily what I did was write because that was my favorite talent. And I was getting paid to write. And to me, that was more fun than to get paid to stack chickens.
Right.
Which I had done when I was younger. I had been a chicken stacker for Tyson's Frozen Chickens. And like to me, that was so much more meaningful to do something writing. And even as a young writer, my whole goal, like if you ask me, what's your professional goal? If you go back and ask 20-something Brandon, it would be, I would be so excited if I could write novels and provide for my family doing it. If I could make writing my life and make enough money to provide for my family. And there are a lot of people like you who you might not be making feature films, but like that you found a way, like with that friend you were talking to mm-hmm. who teased you about humble bragging about being on set,
yeah.
where you do get to make film your life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You do get to, you professionally get to do film and maybe it's not everything you always wanted to make. And yet maybe who's to say that might not still happen because you have kept that door open such right. that you have a lot of kids. You've been doing this a lot of years. You live in a nice house. I've been there. And you have provided that by doing film, by doing something that you love. And
which is crazy to think of, right?
Yeah. So I guess what I'm saying is the young me, if I wanted to write novels and if I had not been able to write novels, which I'm so grateful that I got it, that I've been able to do that. If I had still been able to pay my bills by writing, that would have felt like a pretty big win to me. That yeah. would have felt yeah, pretty yeah. good. You know what I mean? And I think it's worth mentioning to listeners that if you are trying to achieve a high creative goal, but part of the reason you want to do that is because you love the thing, because you love writing or you love filmmaking or you love that art form that you are pursuing, sometimes there are adjacent fields where you can kind of get what you want and you can still leave the door open to do more. Like had I never crossed over into writing novels, that's what I would be doing. And it wouldn't have been a bad life.
Right.
And for me, because I kept trying to cross into novels and because I stayed somewhere adjacent to writing novels, eventually I did cross over into writing novels. And I know others who have done that too. And for you, filming this commercial feels like, getting really close to crossing into the scenario you've always wanted to live.
For sure. And it's not, you know, I've thought about this a bunch. Like I do, that's still my goal is to direct a feature film. But even doing this podcast, right, is film adjacent, right? I'm still producing a show. And even though it's a monthly show and whatnot, I'm still producing a show. I'm still putting together. I've got a small team beyond Brandon and I producing the show, and it's storytelling as well. Even though it's nonfiction storytelling, it's still storytelling. And
right.
And you know, I've often thought like, what if your career just turned into podcasting? Would I be happy with that? I'm like, yeah, that would be great. As long as I
you would have a cool creative job. I would job. Have,
yeah, and instead of a cool creative side gig, right? but yeah, this is and you know, and I do the Dungeons and Dragons podcast as well, right? Which is the best because I get to play my favorite game, which is Dungeons and Dragons, while I'm producing a show at the same time, and so I was able to take a couple hobbies and bring them together into something where it's part of the creative process for me.
I'm glad you got into that because part of what you have done is created lots of inroads into creative things that you like. Like we didn't really mention except at the very start that you've also made some board games.
Yeah.
You're a creative human being who enjoys creating, and you find ways to make that part of your life.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's more on the hobby side. And sometimes if you're smart and kind of tricky and crafty, you go, hey, I can take this hobby and maybe start to monetize it a little bit, or maybe start to monetize it a lot.
Yeah, like the board game is probably the weirdest thing in my career, right? Is because a lot of people want to make a board game, and a lot of people want to sell a board game and have it in stores. And like, I've had the experience of picking up a copy of Feast and Famine, my board game, in a Walmart. Right. Like very few people will ever have that experience in their whole life. But that was just me making a game with friends and play testing it and doing all this stuff. But it wasn't until I was deep into it that I realized that board games is a form of storytelling. Right.
Right.
I'm telling a story with a beginning, middle, and end. I'm retelling the story of Joseph in Egypt anciently, with the 7 years of famine and the 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. And, you know, it's one of the things that I was most proud of in that game was I brought in my friend from high school, Ryan Brayman, that I made the films with. He became just one of the most talented artists on this planet. And he did all the art for that board game. And we took each of Joseph's 11 brothers, and we looked up symbolic images that are associated with each of the brothers, like Reuben, the oldest, is associated with a mandrake, right? And so he has a mandrake head on there, like this plant head, and then coupled it with Egyptian art styles, right? And so, like, even if you just look at the art of this board game, it tells a story that is so rich and compelling, and yeah, it was awesome to be a part of that project and to put that together for sure.
My kids have played this board game. My family all really likes the board game, but like, kind of what I'm saying here is, it can be surprising how, if you're passionate about creating stuff and you keep your mind open, there's all these different ways to do it.
Yeah.
Right? There's all these different satisfying roads that you can go down. For me, I never planned on doing a podcast. I didn't have enough. My job demands a lot time.
Right.
And so I just never, but because you had some enthusiasm for it, this for me has become another fun outlet. It's a place where I can try to give back a little bit, try to share some expertise.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I get a lot of young writers who ask me for tips, and now I have a place I can refer them where, hey, I'm dishing out a lot of tips on this podcast. And it's just that, like, if your main thing that you think you want isn't coming true yet, don't forget that there might be some adjacent places you
right,
can
right,
look, right.
right?
Like where
and
you can...
And you should probably spend your time in those places too.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Because if you're in the neighborhood, maybe you'll be in the right spot when an opportunity comes
along. There's a funny joke in the film, The Man Who Knew Too Little, with Bill Murray, where he tells everybody he's in the film business, his character, but he really works at Blockbuster. And that was like the inside joke for their family. But it's the same thing. He wanted to be a filmmaker, and he ended up working at Blockbuster, this film-adjacent industry. And, you know, anyway, I always related to that a little bit, I guess.
Well, and almost part of the punchline there is Tarantino used to work at Blockbuster.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like there are guys who did work at Blockbuster and get really familiar with movies and mm-hmm. get really passionate about it and become a world-renowned director.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so there is something to be said for if you can't be doing exactly what you want to do, but you can do something that's like what you want to do that still scratches some of those same itches and is still satisfying, that might not be a terrible way to proceed in life.
Yeah, and I'm sure I could have made more money in different industries doing different things, but I would not have been creatively fulfilled.
Yeah, you know, I had a PR teacher at BYU who mapped something out that was so simple. This guy had a long PR career at Dow Chemical, and so he had made a lot of money. That's a huge company. You know, he'd been a very senior PR guy there, and he just graphed it for us. He said, look, I'm going to help explain to you how your life will look. And he's like, at the start of your, and he just had a very simple graph. And he's like, at the start of your career, you will place money as a very important thing and job satisfaction as a low thing. And as you go forward living out your life, you will watch the importance of the money slide down as the importance of the job satisfaction goes up. As you realize that this is my life, and if I don't enjoy my job somewhat, I will reach the end of my life, or I could reach the end of my life with some money and feeling like I never lived.
Yeah.
And so like it really is beautiful and worthwhile if in the pursuit of money, in the pursuit, because we have to make money, we have to survive, you know, we have to make at least enough to survive in this world. But if in that pursuit, we can do something that fills us with some life and that makes us self-actualize a little bit, makes us feel like we've accomplished something maybe we were meant to do or that we hoped we had in us, that can end up being a lot more important as you mature in your life, as you mature in your career, maybe especially, I mean, because this guy might have been right that as you get older, it becomes more important because as your kids grow up and maybe your financial needs go down finally after they've been high for a while, you might reach a point where you're like, wait, do I like my life? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's also like I'm not disappointed with my career either, right? Like I'm satisfied with it. But I've also had opportunities where I have discovered, I've been put in the right place at the right time to do things that were meaningful and impactful. Let me tell you a quick story.
Please,
I'm going to tell you a long story.
Yeah. Good.
Several years ago, a guy came into our office, Chad Anderson. He had an idea for a documentary. And I usually say no to documentaries because they don't have funding. But there was a murder that took place in southern Utah in 1988. Gordon Church was abducted by two men. He was sexually assaulted and tortured by these men, and then eventually murdered and put into a shallow grave. I mean, when you say shallow grave, I mean talking like kicking dirt and branches on top of this mangled body, and he was killed because he was gay. And I heard this story that Chad was telling me, and the passion that he had for this, and virtually unheard story. Or untold story, and I just felt like this story was important to get out there and to be told, and so I produced this documentary where we were able to interview people all surrounding this case, including one of the killers, and then also the family member of one of the killers who's on death row and stuff, and it was an emotionally charged experience, right? The whole thing, and it opened my eyes to so many different things going on in our world, and as that film was concluding our production of it. My oldest son came out to me as gay, to my wife and I, and this film helped me kind of prepare for what type of world we've created for those who are LGBTQ and the dangers that were presented there. And my son came out like the week he was graduating from high school, and then he was moving on to college. And within just a couple weeks of him coming out to me, or my wife and I, and telling us that he was gay, we were moving him into an apartment at SUU that was a block and a half away from where Gordon Church was abducted 25 years prior. And I was thinking to myself, like, how is my world turned into this where now I have to trust society not to do to my son what that was done to another human being. And I left my son there just worried for his life and worried about the experiences of LGBTQ individuals. And it became a passion of mine to make this world a better place for queer individuals across the board, and I had a lot of opportunities to do support groups and other things with it. But where this story takes a turn is, and we're not shy about, you know, Brandon and I are both members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and very open about that. But the church is also one of my clients. And I have done some videos for the church, and they were about to, this was years ago, they were starting a production on how to make a church a better place for LGBTQ individuals, right? And because of being a client there and being passionate about this project, I was selected to direct this series of videos for the church, and interviewed over 70 different queer members of the church around the world. We even filmed for a week in Australia for this, and just had this amazing experience. And I thought to myself, like, how was I put in this position where two of my biggest passions were colliding in a way that my voice could be heard as a director in this process. And the series of videos are still being worked on and eventually will be released. But it was just cool to be put in a place where I could make an impact on something that was important to me, because my career had put me in a place where my voice could be heard in a way that it couldn't any other way. So,
yeah, that's so powerful and so interesting. I love that you were able to find so much meaning in it. And I really do think, because of my own beliefs, to me it sounds like probably God was moving you around to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I believe that. I believe that.
To do some good for special groups and to use your best talents in cool ways. You know, I trust that in my career, that yeah, hopefully as I do my best to do my job well and to put my best into it, that hopefully God will help me find situations where I can do something worthwhile, yeah, too.
And the only reason I bring that up is if my career ends up where that's the most important thing I ever produce and direct, I'm satisfied, right? If I have to give up producing or directing, you know, big Hollywood films, but I've done something that has impacted people in a positive way. Like how can I turn away from that? I'd pick that 10 times out of 10 to be able to be used in that way and have my talents used like that. So
yeah, that's beautiful. And it's not the only example.
Yeah, yeah. There, oh, I for mean, sure, for sure.
There's many different cool things you've been able to do, and you just keep living out your life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And seeing what the next opportunity is that arrives, and who knows what next year holds for you.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, you know what? I appreciate you taking the time to kind of let us dig into your world a little bit and your creative brain. Are there any final thoughts of what you have learned as you have been on your journey in film?
You know, no, I'm excited for the future. You know, I am 47 years old, turning 48 here next month, and you know, becoming an old man. But I am excited for the. I think when I, you know, in 20 years when I retire, I think some of my best work will be in the decades ahead. So I'm excited. I'm just excited for that. And then also, you know, just mentioning the podcast, I'm grateful to be able to do this podcast with you. It's funny, when we named this podcast, my name for the podcast that I suggested was Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole, and your suggestion was Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole and Jason Conforto, right?
Yeah.
And I rejected that just because my name didn't bring anything to the table and that title would just be ridiculously too long. And you were like, well, maybe someday we can change it to that. But I'm okay. I like the center of attention, right? I love talking. I love hearing my voice. I love doing all that.
Sure.
But like, I also get what this is, and I'm also thrilled to be on the producing side of this and to asking the questions and to be able to create something with this podcast. So I'm just grateful for this opportunity too. So
that's good. I'm glad. And we have some interesting authors coming up in some of the future episodes. We already have.
Yeah, should we tease some of that, or do we want to, is it?
I can tease a little bit. Yeah, I mean, like we have Ali Condi has committed to come on the show, and Jennifer Nielsen has committed to come on the show, and we have a couple other guests lined up as well. And so I'm looking forward to some of the conversations we'll be able to have. For me, it's a fun form of professional development to talk to people who are experts and passionate in their craft and hear what they've learned as they've lived a life doing it. And so, yeah, you should see some really fun stuff coming up in the coming months. So Jason, thank you so much for letting us flip our roles for an episode, letting me be the interviewer.
Hey, and great job interviewing today and taking over.
Yeah, doing my best. And hey, thank you for listening, and we will talk to you again soon.
Hey there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second. We don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.